So did that answer the question?
Yes, pretty much.
Okay.
That's ramification.
Of course, that's there. But I'm just talking about the individual, how it could be used. But the thing is the maturity it would take to use it, generally someone on that mature platform wouldn't use it. But if, let us say, the person, you know, he grew up and that's all he was a rock musician, so he may have a lot of baggage in this way that he has to deal with, but that's his specific. Who else can claim that they, you know, grew up, you know, their parents were rock musicians, they grew up, they had a band, they were always traveling, that's all they did, that was their whole life, and then
it's like a catch 22 type of thing.
Yeah.
If you can see Krishna in it, you can hear rock. But if you see Krishna, you won't hear rock.
yeah. Means you only get the rock, not Krishna. Rock means big boulder around the neck. Yeah. So that's the thing of the metaphysical. It has that element. It's able to deal with duality. But because you're dealing with the very technical science, then when you're working in there, it works really nice, or it doesn't. You know, because you're still dealing with the material element. It's not like chanting, that you chant and you're thinking of so many other things, and it still is going to function. Though it may not function, it means you'll be liberated. You know, it is, you're in association with Krishna. So you're not going to be so many, you know, distractions, but you're not going to get the full thing. But this other thing, you'll actually be getting the material association. So it becomes dangerous like that. That's why even these things where they use all these material things, they still have to have guru. Means you have, like, let's say your Shaivites and Shaktas and that, and they'll use all kinds of wild things, you know, like that. But you still have to have a guru to make sure that even within that path you're still progressing and not getting distracted. Is that okay?
When Srila Prabhupada asked all of his initiated disciples not to listen to non-devotional mundane music, so when rock music played for Krishna, is it devotional or is it still mundane music but played by devotees?
What is your body? You're there in the deity room offering artik. What's your body? Is it spiritual or spiritualized?
Spiritualized.
So it's the same thing. Point is for those who are attached to rock music, devotional rock music is then a step up from rock music. Better they listen to that than the original stuff. You know what I'm saying? You know what I'm saying? In other words, if somebody likes to listen to that music, don't worry about it. You don't have to go on a crusade that, you know, this is bad and start up a thing and GBC should make a resolution. And like, don't worry about it. The point is, you know, it's connected to Krishna and they like it, let them listen to it. You don't have to listen to it. You know, but at the same time, they should be considerate that they shouldn't, by their listening to it, make you listen to it. You know, shouldn't be in their house and they got the loudspeakers turned up and their windows open. They shouldn't do that. You know, if the devotees don't appreciate it, it shouldn't be loud. And they shouldn't say, "Well, it's in my house, I do what I like." And it's like, then you do what you like. You know? You also go out and buy yourself, you know, a few hundred watts and stick it at the window and blast some music. You know? So, I mean, you know what I'm saying? It's just, it has to be, that's then where it becomes, you know, unbeneficial. In other words, if it's your private problem, keep it private. But when you start making my private problem is fine, and therefore everybody else has to live with it, then that's where where your private problem starts to become an offense. You know what I'm saying? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So that's the thing. It's like, yeah, one has to balance. So if it's not according to tradition, that you can use whether people like it or not. You know what I'm saying? But if it's not according to tradition, then you have to be a little careful. Right? Because then it will be specifically individual. You know what I'm saying? You know, you like rock music, you know, the other devotee likes rock music, but he doesn't like the band that you like. So why should he be forced to listen to the band you like? Same time as there's devotees who don't like rock music, so why should they have to listen to it? You know what I'm saying? So it becomes very individual. Does that make sense? Like that. So as soon as you take it that it's your right and you can do whatever you like in public, then that's the point where your right stops and others' rights start. You know what I'm saying?
For example, public program, the cultural evening of India's culture evening, and then on the end, the spice on the end, a rock part. How does that fit together?
The people like it. They stay for it. It gets them dancing. They chant Hare Krishna. They dance like that. They enjoy, you know, the. Like that, so then that brings them a little closer. May not be, you know, Indian, but it's, what I'm saying, by that part it may or may not be consistent, but as far as, you know, it gets them all, especially if they're singing Hare Krishna and this and that, you know, if the artists themselves aren't too enthusiastic about presenting their own very clever lyrics, you know, that's when it starts to become. But you can tell that it's spiritual, but it's still going on. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
It means at the beginning of the tour, the band is there and the same people are there. At the end of the tour, 3 months later, they're still there. There's a good chance there may be some spiritual element to it. You know what I'm saying? Because otherwise, for 3 months, every night, they couldn't do that if it was purely mundane. You know what I'm saying? Because who's recognizing? You know, where's the money? Where's the fame? Where's the facility? That's what keeps the rock musicians going. You know what I'm saying? Because in that group, they have had devotees who wanted to get more serious about the music and have separated and created their own band. Those bands don't exist anymore. They went out, they went on the road, they did their thing, they bought their Mercedes Benz, they did their things, and now they don't exist. That makes sense. So the more they can connect it, then you see the more Hare Krishna there is, the better. Because the words are nice, you get a few words in that, but then if you bring it around to that, then that's nice. Or if you're doing it just to make money so that they can, you know, then do the program, that's another thing. It should be noted that there are superior and inferior engagements. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So one should never foolishly try to present an inferior engagement as equal to a superior engagement. You know what I'm saying? And one should have the character to accept that I'm engaging this lower thing, and it is lower, and my attachments are lower. But I'm trying to deal with them. Not that it's fine or it's okay. It's never fine. Material attachment's never okay. Being in the material world, since when has it been okay? Right? It means it's not okay. But if that's what you have to deal with it. You're hungry, eat. You're not hungry, why would you eat? You know, why would you snack when you're not hungry? That makes sense? Like that. So, and then just because you're there, you're eating and it's a fast day, but you know, you're taking some fruit and milk or something like that, and others are fasting, you can't say, oh, it's okay if you eat, you know, it's okay, well, you know, it's just fine. It is fine. It's fine for you, but be quiet. The others are fasting, that's better for them. That's what's good for them. So don't try to make their standard, bring theirs down to your standard. Why this homogenous, it's all one? Oh, I'm eating, and those who don't eat are fanatics. You know, or the ones as we're not eating, so the ones eating, you know, they're out of it. Does that make sense? It's a matter of what you need to do, you do. You can, recommendation is fasting. You can fast, do it. If you can't, due to health reasons or whatever it is, then eat something. Does that make sense? And then go on with devotional service. So even if you're enthused, okay, you're enthused. Keeps you enthused. You listen to your rock music and this and that. So then after that, what service happens? What service has been benefited by your enthusiasm of listening to rock music? Does that make sense? If there is, great. If there's not, then it's just talk. Talk's cheap. Anybody can talk. But you say it creates enthusiasm. Where is that enthusiasm? How did it result in a Krishna conscious endeavor? If it creates enthusiasm for listening to more mundane music, great, okay. But, you know, what has that got to do with Krishna? So when you say it generates enthusiasm, that enthusiasm then should be for doing service.
But enthusiasm certainly doesn't match that.
Yeah, endeavor with intelligence.
Yeah,
favorable service. So you have to be able to, and that's the point, is be able to pull Krishna out of it. So the more metaphysical, the more you technical. That's why our process is simple living, high thinking, because you live simply, you have less things that you have to do this whole metaphysical gymnastics with. You know what I'm saying? You have this. When I came to India, houses, they were empty. Big monster houses. Wealthy people. One room does one thing. Not this one room is for everything. There's one room where when they buy rice by sacks, they don't go out every day and buy it or buy a little. They go out and buy, you know, a few hundred kilos of rice. Or they buy, you know, 1,000 kilos, whatever, for the whole year. And when it's in season, and then they have a go down for it. Then they have a room where they bring the sack of rice, dump the whole sack out on the floor, marble floor, of course, and then all the ladies in the house sit around and clean the rice, you know, while they talk and socialize and all that kind of thing. There's a room just for that. There's a room just for when guests come that are acquaintance only, or just like that. It's in the front of the house. It's not in the living room. You can't walk into the living room. Nowadays they have a little dinky thing called a foyer. Before, the foyer was a full-on, you know, place that had bathrooms and places for sitting and the whole. You could. It was like a living room, but it was for outside people. Only inside people came into the place where, you know, family functions would go. You know. They had monster kitchens. But if you looked at the place had hardly anything in it. It would have only what needed to be there for that work. You know, there's one room you walk in, the first one's just got a big seat on it. The next one you walk in's got a swing. The next one you walk in, that one has some seating, you know, other seating arrangements on the floor and stuff. You know what I'm saying? Well, now if you go into a house, it's packed with stuff. I mean, chockers with stuff. I'm not talking karmic houses. I'm talking devotees. And I give the example of the, you know, quarter round table on the landing with a little vase with the dry flowers in it. I'm talking devotees' houses. I don't walk into karmic houses like that, or the same thing on the top of the toilet. You know, on the toilet lid, you know, the flesh toilet lid, you know, you have the little, what do you call it, porcelain little designer thing with the little something, you know, to give some, you know, like that. And then you have the little glass there with all the colored rocks in it, and, you know, and the basket with, you know, 500 cosmetics in it. And another, you know what I'm saying? Is that they're there. So how are they? It's complicated. So how do you explain it? If you can explain it, fine. That's the thing. We have no problem. Make it as complicated, but explain it. And just I like it or it looks good is not enough. And if you ask, that's the only reason. You know, life's good. They look good. Trying to create a nice atmosphere. Great. But, you know, what do you like? What are you trying to do with it? Does that make sense? So then that's there. So then it doesn't matter. You know, the guy has to wear a three-piece suit to go to work. Great. Explain it. Why? You know what I'm saying? You know what I'm saying? You know, I'm a Shudra. I work for this company. And in this company, I have to deal with a lot of, persons coming from other business concerns or clients. And because we do a certain service, we project a certain, what would be the word? Image, yeah. So therefore the three-piece suit matches that image. Right? And so that's why specifically the suit. Now why would I choose a job that does that? Because that's what I have a nature to be able to do. I can excel in that. I can make, you know, pleasingly make my money, and with that money I can maintain my house and Krishna consciousness, my family. You know, I can do service for the temple, things like that. So that's an explanation. But generally if you ask this, oh, don't be fanatic or this or that, all we ask for is an explanation. Atato Brahma Jigyasa is the first verse, the Vedanta Sutra. There's 554 other ones. We're only talking about the first one. Why? That's all. Even your kid will ask you why. You know? So I'm saying, you know, we're not talking about, you know, great intellectual gymnastics here. You know? I'm sure the kid asked, Daddy, why do you have to wear this weird outfit? You know? What's that funny, you know, rag hanging around your neck? You know? You know what I'm saying? So it means, you know, of course you tell the kid, shut up, daddy's busy. But that's my point is, therefore it's not human life. So we're devotees, we practice human life. Human life means why. So explain why. That's all. Doesn't matter. You can have a million things in your house, but explain why they're there. Either individually or collectively. There has to be some connection. And the more connection you have, the more vibrant your house will be with Krishna consciousness. And if there's not, then there's always going to be those little dark corners that you try to brighten up with things that you have no explanation for. You know, I'm saying? Also a catch-22. That make sense? In other words, Krishna consciousness is a very straightforward, down-to-earth philosophy and system. But it's just, as someone put once, though it may or may not be well understood, one devotee once told me, he says, Prabhupada is the most normal person. Normal meaning not crazy. Everybody else is in varying degrees of insanity. Insane, more insane, most insane, right? But Prabhupada is just normal. Complicated because there's mental speculation. Why would I choose impersonalists? Because Prabhupada says philosophy without religion is mental speculation. That's why I chose that. And devotees all means your Western devotees accept the philosophy, but not much of the culture. So the tendency is towards mental speculation. Well, the Indians accept the culture, but not the philosophy, therefore it's sentiment. Does that make sense? So, sense speculation is the platform which the Westerners are more comfortable with. why not use it to advantage and contemplate all the reasons why you don't accept the culture? You know what I'm saying? But generally what it is they accept the culture of the West without the philosophy of the West, so they're just sentimentalists there. Because the persons who are committed to the Western lifestyle, they have a philosophy, you know. They're going to enjoy it. They're going to get as much out of this as they want. You know, they're like real, like solid, hardcore Taoists, you know. But, I think Prahlad was talking to somebody. It was very amusing, to a Chinese person, I think. A Taoist. And he was saying, well, you know, because they accept everything's temporary and it's all this or that, you know, so because they're impersonalists. But at the same time, as it's like, you know, they're endeavoring very hard for material facility. And then within it, you know, and their thing is that they excel. They have such egos and like that. And so, I can't remember exactly, but basically the man's point, he was asking, why are you endeavoring so much? Because he says, you know, it says, that I say is that basically all there is in the world is you know, eating, sleeping, mating, defending, and I'm going to make sure that I've got the best there is, you know. So it's kind of like our philosophy in complete absolute reverse, you know, its purpose and everything, you know. But it's, they're committed to the material world. That's why you see the Orientals are so, they prosper so quickly. You know, you take something as backwards as China was, there are more high skyscraper buildings, I would say, than other than America, any other country on the planet. And just built in a few years. While these others have been building on it for, you know, long time. These buildings go back to the 20s, 30s. In New York, you got stuff that goes way back. LA, they go way back. You know? Like that. But you look in these other places, you go to Beijing. You know, it's not only that they knew, they're all different colors. There's blue ones and yellow ones. And yeah, I mean, they're just, I mean, you know, it's like you see in movies these space age, you know, what do you call it? The skyline. There it's reality. That's just normal. You know, space age skyline is just, you know. Shanghai, the other side of the river, everything is just all by lights and all these mystical kind of like floating things and all that. One side is all like, you know, 100-year-old, you know, granite, you know, bank buildings, you know, built by the Europeans. And the other side of the river is all this high-tech, you know, latest, you know, just amazing things. And not just this much of it, it's like that much of it. You know? And I saw it maybe, what, 5 years ago, and I've heard it's way more now. You know, it's like, I was there, you know, saying, yeah, the Sydney skyline is kind of like, okay, it goes from there to there. You know, and the Melbourne skyline, it goes from there to there. You know, or London, there isn't a skyline, because they don't like skyscrapers, so it's all flat. You know, I think one was built once, and no one would use a building like that. Yeah, it was built, you know, with the idea, the American thing, and then the British would never use, they'll use the lower floors, no one wants to use the top floors. So I don't know what happened to it, but it's still there, but yeah, not used. It's kind of like a, so it's like that, but you know, New York, it's from there to there. You know, it's like, that's that, but that's taken a long time to build. They've just built it like that, so what material determination they have to go from a place that looks like India to that, in 3.7 seconds. You know what I'm saying? It's like, and so they're materially committed. So that's why devotees are stuck in the middle. That's what's his name? Arjuna was afraid of. Because they're not committed spiritually to the culture. It's like they're committed to the spiritual philosophy and the material culture, and so then it's really hard to excel in either. Right? I mean, think about it. Of devotees endeavoring for money, how many really have it? There are, there's devotees that are millionaires. We have them. but they're committed to it. You know, it's like somebody's telling me there were 5 millionaires in Alachua. I don't know now, but this was some years ago when it was explained to me. They all run businesses. One devotee exclusively, one business person, one of the business devotees exclusively hires devotees. And I think he said there are two that exclusively, absolutely, as a policy, will never hire a devotee. Because he says they're the worst employees that you can get. You know? And this is down south, where you're going to have plenty of Hispanics and other persons who are not known for being great employees. And so they classify the devotees as worse than that. So they won't. And then there's one who, because it's, you know, want to engage devotees and see that they get money and taken care of, they'll only hire devotees despite them not being necessarily good employees. And then the other two, if you're good, you can. It doesn't matter. You're a devotee or not devotee, they'll hire you. But if you're not good, they won't hire you just because you're a devotee. So that's the thing, is that that focus is not there. That focus is there. You know. So if that's there, it works. You see a zone that's, how you say, the East Block, when it opened up, the focus was there within no time. They had like 100 temples and centers in Russia. But do you ever hear of, I mean, that was dynamic. Do you hear of the dynamic growth of Russia now? No, because the focus is not there anymore. So it's simple. When focus is there, it happens. When focus is not there, it's not a matter of this, that. It's just a point. It doesn't matter. Oh, well, it's an old yatra and so many things and so much baggage and so many devotees have left. And gone. No, it's nothing to do with that. You focus, it works. If you don't, it doesn't. Right? Because otherwise, if it was so bad, then why is it they can go out and get a job and do it? Right? If you can't, you're so spun out that your spiritual master fell down, that you can't perform any devotional activities, how are you able to perform material activities? Right? The mother loses a husband or a son or a father, the girl loses, she's not able to do anything. Eating has no meaning, she doesn't like to dress up, she doesn't want to go anywhere, she doesn't want to see anybody. But very enthusiastic, they go out there and get jobs, make money, buy cars, run around, have parties. So that means they're not that affected. If they were, they wouldn't be able to do that either. You know what I'm saying? So it's a nice excuse. But after 20 years, you kind of think people get over it. You know, you think after 20 years that your spiritual master fell, you might be able to get it together and do something. You know, unless you were that committed that you're just so, you know. But I doubt it. I think it's just a really great excuse. So the point is they're focused on the material, therefore they're prospering. But the more they focus, the better they get. It's just a mundane thing. If there's focus and there's endeavor, then you can talk about result. But if there's no focus, no endeavor, there's no result. That's just, that is the formula how the material energy functions. That's all. You know what I'm saying? So it's not an illusory thing. It's the way it works. So you focus, it works. You focus on spiritual life, you get spiritual. You focus on material, you get material. So we're recommending that you focus on spiritual. So in the beginning, because of that attachment material, we generally only talk about spiritual. Just focus on, and we don't even talk about the material. Someone who's smart understands that that focus is what makes either work. So therefore, then they do. Prabhupada, like when you brought in a very hardcore, successful materialist, Prabhupada was very happy to meet them. Why? Because here's someone who's focused. If that person took up Krishna consciousness, bingo! You got yourself a temple president, GBC preacher, leader of the Hare Krishna movement. You know? But you bring in some spaced out, living off, you know, the government, you know, hippie that can't do anything. then it's nice. They're a soul, they're chanting Hare Krishna, going back to Godhead. As far as the big preaching goes, Prabhupada is much happier to see these gross materialists. Because if you convince them, you got somewhere. Now, you look at Chopati, successful men. They take up Krishna consciousness. You have a successful yatra. I think as a single temple, they have more dynamic programs going on than any other temple in the movement. You know, probably other than here, because the place is so big. But other than Mayapur, then as far as the city temple goes, even as far as farm goes. There's no one has more, and they're dynamic and active and happening. Why? Because they're successful people who know how to focus and know how to manage the material energy. So now they're able to engage the material energy in the spiritual energy, because now they're intelligent enough to distinguish. You know? They're not throwing out the baby with the bathwater. They got money, they make more money. Because now it's for Krishna. You know, and only if it's getting in the way of their devotional life, then they'll cut back. You know, instead of being stinking rich, now they're only filthy rich. You know, that makes sense. So, like that, then this is what's being presented. But if we point out the formulas, material formulas, too early, then we may take those formulas. That's why we're not enthusiastic to teach the Vedic formulas to the karmis. We're not really interested to teach them astrology and this and that, because they'll take the astrology. They won't take the Krishna consciousness. But if you give them Krishna consciousness, along with that comes astrology, then that's okay. So that's, one has to be very careful in that. The New Age preaching is, where is it lying? Okay, we're getting into these areas, but are they being engaged? Are they chanting? Are they taking up the process? You know, are they reading the books? Like that. And then gradually with time, other practices will naturally come. Right? But otherwise then it's just your service. Okay, you know yoga, you do it, you open a center, you make money, you maintain your family, but that's it. You know, you're a yogi by occupation. And now and again, some people you bring in, and great, no problem. But then it's your occupation as opposed to your preaching. You know, you, and wherever you can, you add some preaching to it, but its bulk is an occupation. And that's okay, but as long as you accept it that way. But if you say, no, this is all preaching, no, it's not. You know, what's preaching is preaching, what's not is not. But what's not, you're maintaining a Krishna conscious family, you're doing some with it. So therefore it's also spiritual. It's spiritualized. May not be as dynamic as the other, but it is. It's connected. So you'll progress. Does this make sense?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. You had something to
do? Mark, I wanted to ask questions of clarification about things you said some years ago.
Okay.
Basically, because I want to teach them, and I want to make sure I'm remembering them correctly. Okay. If that's okay with you.
Yeah.
There are two things. One is in terms of the three levels of study and analysis of Bhagavatam. The systematic, thematic, and conceptual. And the other thing was, I remember a long, long time ago, what I remembered was the word sampat in terms of being part of the culture of studying. Oops. How you take shelter of Guru and the Acharya who's written the work at the beginning and at the end, you do something else.
Yeah, well, that was from when the Brahmacharis study. That they chant Om at the beginning of the studies and Om at the end. You know, so we'd sing Jai Radha Madhava and, you know, say, you know, like at the end of class, Baba would always say, Hare Krishna, thank you very much, and, you know, stuff like that. So, or that's why we'll, you know, be more obvious, we'll, the kids will chant Hare Krishna. you know, do a mantra of Hare Krishna. But in the chanting at the beginning, that gives you the ability to understand what will be taught. Right? And the spiritual sound at the end of the lesson makes it so that you are able to retain what you've learned and to be able to apply it.
Was it called sampat? Was it such a
word? I think it's sampat means that it's closed like that. It's in relationship to a mantra. A mantra always has a B syllable and then the end. You have namaha at the end, is swaha, and you have an om or something. So that's sampat. It's enclosed. So they do the same thing with the knowledge, with the education. It's the same principle. That's why we use the term like that.
I didn't understand.
Yeah. So that's.
I remember you also saying something about being conscious of approaching the knowledge by the student, being conscious of approaching the knowledge by like praying to the Acharya and
Yeah, well, it would be an extension of that. It means that you're chanting those mantras, but the whole purpose is to invoke. It means you do it, you'll get the benefit. If you're conscious of that, then it's you'll get more out of it. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
You know, so it's, in other words, that's the nice thing about bhakti, is that basically it's foolproof. You know, us being the fools, is that despite us, if we don't make any offenses and we follow the process, it will work. That's the great thing about it. Mm-hmm. You know, that's why I'm saying is that the directly devotional activities always work. The metaphysical works if you're conscious of it. That's why in Jnana Yoga, a Jnana Yogi is always intellectualizing on things. So therefore, they can do that in everything. While the karma yogi within the Buddha yoga process will be more into the activity and a little less on intellectualizing. The philosophy is there, but connecting the two, that metaphysic part is either not attractive or inaccessible.
I'm actually finding fascination with it because it seems to be a stepping stone from going from Kanishka mentality to Madhya.
Yeah. Well, it's a natural Madhyam platform. Is to be able to see all those things, and you know, in other words, at Nishta it will be more intellectual, and as one goes, it will be more the Krishna aspect. Because in other words, the Nishta will be you see Krishna in the column as the potency and the beauty, but that's basically where it stops. But as taste goes, then it's Krishna, and then it goes on to, you know, chanting or remembering, and Asakti definitely will do that, and Bhava is just, you know, it's just a stepping stone, a momentary, you know, it's a, what do you call it? Udipan, that's all. You know, you have a black tree, it's just a black tree, but then it's Krishna, and they embrace it, and they think of Krishna, take shelter of it when Aristasura comes. So it's Krishna. It's not a tree that has Krishna's blackness, so therefore it's like Krishna. No, it's Krishna. So it means the Udipan is so strong, it just reminds of Krishna, and they're already in Krishna Lila. Like that. So that it becomes, so it's used constantly, this thing, but here it's like a big intellectual, pain. Because we're not used to thinking about things other than our attachments. The mind thinks about stuff at once and will contemplate how to get it. That we're used to doing. You know, I mean, mudhas may or may not. Sometimes you have a mudha who just completely is just governed by the moment, you know, the senses and all that. But most people, you know, above that are they use their brain only that much, but be able to distinguish in things where we're not seemingly getting any material profit from, that's more difficult. You know, yeah, of course. So intellectuals do it, but then they don't bring it to the ground. So then therefore they're kind of written off as an example. So they're not an inspiration. And the modern, you know, Padati, then philosophers aren't really an inspiration. A little bit, you know, you'll take one point and that, and, you know, something, be nice, be good, or something, all that kind of thing. But they're technical points generally people don't use because they themselves don't make it practical. You know, they don't. You know, you hear one or two that make it practical, but it's like Socrates was more practical. But kind of as it goes down the line, it starts to get more and more away. You know, like that. I'm not sure that Diogenes, the Greek guy, wasn't kind of practical. You know, he lived what he talked, you know. He was the one that would I think, live in a barrel or something, or in a cave. And then what's his name? Alexander the Great came to see him, and he came with his, you know, all his generals and ministers, and he came and he, you know, came to see him and talked with him a little bit, and, you know, and after talking, then, you know, was that he was very impressed. So he said, "Is there anything I can do for you that would please you?" And he says, "Yes, you can move out of the sun. You're blocking the sun," like that. You know, it's, you know, and it was like anything. You know, it's one of those things you would have given him the empire probably if he'd asked or something. And so, you know, Alexander then, you know, very respectfully, you know, bowed and left. And after they got some distance, and all his, you know, his associates, the generals and other things, he just said, "Man, what a fool." He says, "You offered him anything he wanted, and he only asked you to step out of the sunlight." Like that, you know, this guy really, you know, they were just laughing about how this, like that. And Alexander said, "If I wasn't Alexander the Great, I'd want to be him." yeah. So it's like, you know. So, yeah. So it was impressive enough that that what he said is what he lived, and it had some practical uplifting value rather than just their, you know, some of these like French guys and stuff. That one guy, somebody came. I think he had 15 mistresses. No, 15 kids. I think something ridiculous. He was a real debauchee. I mean, disgusting debauchee. You know, all you do is hang out at pubs, and that very bad. And somebody who was an associate or an acquaintance of his made a comment about his, you know, immorality, and this figure that, you know, he should try to. The guy created a philosophy. It's one of the main modern, I think, the existential, or what, I don't remember his name, but he created a whole philosophy to justify his behavior. But he was so smart, he pulled it off, and, you know, people discuss it, and, you know, you go to university and take philosophy, you gotta, you know, talk about his stuff. One of these French guys, I think from the 1700s or something like that, or 1800s, something. It was, you know. So the sampat then is so that completeness is there. You also get that in the knowledge, it's called, what is it? What's the last one, the fifth of the punch? The another one? Sangati. Where the body of knowledge is consistent within itself and with other bodies of knowledge. That's one of the panchanga nyaya. Means the five aspects of nyaya. So in the fifth one, in conclusion, then it also includes sangati, which means verse to verse, there's a continuity. Then that verse to the chapter, chapters to other chapters, the chapter to the book, that book to other bodies. So you would see in Gita, Prabhupada is always giving the sangati to Bhagavatam, and Bhagavatam back to Gita. Like that.
Sangati.
Yeah.
Another thing I wanted to just get a quick... Do you have time, Maharaj?
A little bit, yeah. I mean, if I leave in about 10 minutes.
The other thing that I wanted to just clarify that I caught it right was in terms of the relationship between these three systems of studying Bhagavatam and the flowering of consciousness, how it's actually like an organic and progressive thing. And you mentioned a little bit this morning, like, you know, that we're looking at systematic, we're basically looking at information.
Mm-hmm.
And... questions that indicate that there's contamination of jnana karma, like, you know, when, what,
mm-hmm.
that kind of stuff. And and then the thematic, we're a little more familiar with information, And a lot of the questions that are dealing with our concern for Gyanakam come were answered, and that we're also becoming purified. And so then we're starting to become aware that there's some intelligence at work within the pattern of the information that we're being given. And we start to explore that a lot more, and sort of question why becomes more prominent like that. So that I sort of think in terms of the like that opening up with the more of the consciousness, and that being the thematic and then the conceptual, is all the questions have their play, because it's holistic, it's more and that we come to the understanding that that intelligence is a person. It's Krishna. And so even though those kind of questions are there, they're in relation to Krishna. They're no longer separate things. And you know that at this point we're actually attracted and interested in Krishna as a person. We want to know how he sees things, how he does things, not just from an abstract point of view, which we may want to do in the other two levels, but because we actually want to bring our own perception and way of doing things in line with his. And of course that, if we, you know, we start off at that kind of level, but then if we follow that up, it will sort of come to the point of conceptualization of someone like Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, who can actually use the verses of Bhagavatam to enter into the pastimes and to tell us, you know, what Krishna was saying, what the Gopis are saying, you know, what's between the lines in the Bhagavatam or the Gita or whatever. I just wanted to check whether that was...
Another aspect is that these three are there, so they're kind of like separately approached, but at the same time is they could, I mean, you'd have you'd have each of these having its own particular time in the progress of the study. There would be, and at the same time within that there would be that the other two are means all three are always connected, included in each one. Because in other words the rule is that you study a book from front to back, you don't skip around, because that it is a person, it is a particular body of knowledge, it does have a particular purpose in the way it's presented, so that study must be there, and that's the first study. But in it, it doesn't mean that the concepts and your themes aren't brought out, but they aren't emphasized as much as the natural flow. Right? In other words, you just take them as they come, you know, one after another, because you don't know the whole body, so something that you could connect together, you can't at this point because they don't know it. You know, you're trying to teach the numbers, but and you've got an addition, but they don't know multiplication yet, so you can't bring out an example, that you can't make that connection that... At this point, you don't make the connection that multiplication is adding in groups like that. So all you do is talk about addition. So some of the concepts, some of the themes will come out, but because they're only coming as you go. Then, but when you finish that, then you can go back and look at it in themes, because those points will come up all throughout the whole book because of the Sangati. Right, because they're all connected. They have to be. There's main principles. So those concepts are the thing that the whole book's based on. And then there'll be themes to bring that out, and then there'll be details and examples given through the particular verses. So, you know, so when you study, some concept is given in the chronological study. But you'll bring out more of the conceptual when you deal the thematic, you know, because then you've done the whole work, so then you can grasp the concept complete. Though you've already introduced them to it, so it's not a foreign or a new thing. The idea is that since all of whatever it is that you would want to bring out, let's say for example, let's say in the book you have two main concepts that are there and 10 themes, you know, but then you have the whole book. So those 10 themes will be touched upon every time you come across it. So they get familiar with it, but they won't necessarily put the theme being presented in this chapter with the theme in that chapter, you know, unless those chapters happen to be like there's a common theme in Vyasadeva meets Narad Muni, and that he hasn't, you know, given the, what is it, the, okay, so I was going to say, yeah, I guess Real McCoy, that's the old one, there's a new one, I can't remember what it is, but, so he hasn't given it in a way that people will take it. In other words, they'll take his system materially. So he's pointing out, unless Krishna is directly shown to be connected with everything, people won't get it. So those two chapters, then you can say there's a common theme. So you could point that out in there, mm-hmm. you know, because the two go together. So there's some sangati between that. But once you go on to the chapters after that, then you may not touch on that unless it comes up in a verse or purport again. But then when you go, when you're going back over the whole book, then you can show is that this theme is there and it comes in here, but we also see it here and we see it in this canto here and in this verse here and Uddhava says here and like that. And we can then it strengthens the already basic, those fundamental understanding. And then the concept, well, why is that important? Because that does this. Because the point is always remember Krishna and never forget him. So, therefore, the method that Vyasadeva gave, though a mature person, because he was mature at the time, but not mature enough. That's why Bhagavatam said he wrote it in his maturity, means his realization. So you could say that Mahabharata was written in his expertise. So another expert could use it that way. But only a master can give concepts to a neophyte. Experts can't do that. That's how you can tell the difference between an expert and a master, is that the expert can function with other experts, or people have potential of very quickly coming to that platform. But and they don't like to say things simply, because to experts you don't. You can go on a complicated way, and they can accommodate it, because they're clever. They think in that field, so you can give very complex answers, and it works for them. But for the neophyte, it doesn't, because they don't have that skill. Mm-hmm. So to be able to reduce the essence of that skill or its principles down in a simple way that you could teach it to a kid, that's mastery. That's the difference between the two. But you see, Prabhupada could talk in very seemingly, I mean, it appears to us, simple English, you know, layman's English, and get across the most highest things. While the tendency you would see of other philosophers, Indian philosophers, it's so complicated that I don't even, you know, one wonders whether they understand it. You know, I once someone that had the books of one of these great yogis and all that, and he asked, you know, how is it? And he says, oh, it's so complicated, I can't understand anything, you know, like that. So why do you read it? He says, oh, it's such, you know, in other words, he was impressed by how, but he, you know, naturally he thinks he's smart. But this guy's so much smarter, I can't even understand it. So, you know, there's just that appreciation in reading it, though. You know, it's like that, you know. And this guy, yeah. At that day, any bus body made in India, I mean in East India, is made by his factory. And you know how many buses there are. I don't know if now there's different factories, others have cut in on his thing, but he was the man for making bus bodies. You know, it's like Tata made the chassis, he made the bodies. So he would do all of his work. I'm only saying this to show that he's smart, but, you know, it was so much more complicated. I came into his office to see him, and he walked in, and immediately two phones are ringing, he's talking on two phones, secretaries are walking in, taking, you know, notation and this and that, and so many things. There's no question of getting in a word. You know, it'd be, oh, hi, hello, like this, and just go on like this. After 20 minutes, I said, well, look, you're a little busy, I'll come back later. He said, yeah, come in the afternoon at 4. So then I came at 4, exactly the same thing, but this time I didn't know what to do, because I wasn't going to, I guess, freeze. So I just sat there. And then after 20 minutes, everything stopped. All the phones, all the secretaries, everything. He just leaned back in his chair, and, okay, how can I help you? He ran his whole empire in 40 minutes a day. But what he did in 20 minutes, other guys would take hours and hours to do. So it wasn't that he was not smart. It wasn't just your regular standard buff head, or say boofhead, I say businessman. This guy was one of the top sharp, you know, guys in India. And he read him because he was intellectually stimulated, though he couldn't understand a word he said.
That's the key, that is identifying with the intelligence.
Yeah.
Rather than, like, I don't know, like, bhakti, it seems like it's really really simple.
Yeah, yeah. But it's not that the acharyas can't be technical.
Oh,
I mean, it's like the Tato Brahma Jigyasa. Then Baladev takes Atta. Atato is Atta. He takes that and gives 15-page purport on it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's not that they can't do that. You know, in other words, when it comes to ontology, they can split hairs, you know, more than anybody. But at the same time, they can go the other. That's one of the things, is that when it's talked about, well, they go so deep into rasa and all these different things. Yes, but they can go that deep into the philosophy as well, the technical philosophy. So there's a balance, because if you only go into the one and not the other, unless it's completely, you know, pure, like the gopis, they didn't philosophize, but they surrendered to Krishna, so they didn't need to. But if the conditioning is still present and one only takes the rasa side without the tattva, there'll be an imbalance. Same way, if you only take the tattva, and when rasa comes up, then there's a fear of it. No, that's sahaj. He says what it means. You're just saying that three parts out of four of nectar devotion is for sahajas, or what? You know, it's like, you know, hello. You know, and that was his basic book. Then, to be specific, so you'd really be able to understand the technicalities, he wrote another book, like that. So, you know, it's like. I don't know. I haven't been. You know, I've been so busy with the civics, you know, trying to see if you can make some practical sense of how the devotees can kind of manage their lives, that they don't get so distracted. They either before it was they just leave Krishna consciousness. Now they don't. They just try to change Krishna consciousness to fit their mundane perspective.
Yes.
Yeah, so that's more dangerous. So I've been concentrating on that a lot. So I haven't been.
Maharaj, you mentioned that Sanghiti is the fifth principle. What is this all about?
Means panchanga nyaya means you have a thesis, and basically your thesis can be, you know, your solemn statement of purpose. Right? You can basically say it in one sentence. You know, like Krishna is God. Or, you know, we're not this body, or, you know, like that. Then the second point then is expanding on that. You know, but still it's you're not giving examples of that, you're just giving, based on that principle, further major aspects of it. The third point is where you give all your examples. And that, to, you know, in other words, to bring it near or closer to the person who you're explaining it to. The fourth one, then you synthesize all the various aspects that you brought and bring it back. And then the fifth, yeah.
When you're back in terms of the thesis?
Of the thesis, yeah. And then the fifth is the conclusion. Where, but now it's after all that discussion, then it's kind of like your thesis is presented in a like more mature or applicable way. You know what I'm saying? A practical way. So that's when you're dealing with the faithful. It does have a parallel elements of those five. When you're dealing with doubts and misgivings, which generally one always is in a systematic way. So the first one remains the same. But when you, because with the first one, it's so concise that it's very hard for anyone to militate against it. Right.
Basically, this is your talking principle.
Yeah, it's the core point you want to make. That anything else you're going to say after that is based on that and is hinging off of that. And if you know that, that's why it's recommended as a process. Otherwise, you may be talking for an hour and they don't know what you're talking about. But if you say first, I'm talking about, you know, Krishna's God, then I may give, you know, 20 examples of this and that, and they're all so different, I may not catch the connection. But if I've already heard that Krishna's God, then Krishna's God and how, you know, he's the creator of everything or the destroyer, or he's the one that cares for everybody, or, you know, and they seem very different. But the common thread through the whole thing is Krishna's God. But now, when I say Krishna's God, he is one without a second. No one is equal to him. No one is above him. At that point, I go, well, what about Shiva? Krishna's God, fine. So is Shiva, so is Indra, so is that, so is my son. You know, like that. God, no problem. But it's in the second point where you expand that the doubt comes up. So the doubt becomes the thesis of the other party. You know what I'm saying? That's where their thesis comes up. Mm-hmm. No, but Shiva's God, the Supreme. Like that. So then the third part, where you're giving your explanations, that is actually to establish your point and to clear their point. Right? Yeah. No, you can take his purports and basically just draw lines. Here's this, here's this, here's this. Like that. If you understand these two, because the problem is most, because these are two seemingly separate systems of the same nyaya. Prabhupada explains them both. And what happens is if you try to approach it from the one or from the other, it won't make as much sense as if you understand how the two work. Because, in other words, one is you're simply how to present your point. The other one is how to present your point and clear doubts. So in other words, if it's debate, you use the same formula, but you know when you're going to deal with it. Right? And if there is no debate, then you still complain, because this is logically just how the intelligence works. Because, okay, well, there'll be a third going back over to show the intelligence in mind. So then at the fourth state, where it's synthesis, now you bring together that what they've said and what you said aren't contradictory. Because Shiva is a god, but not the supreme god. And so he is also a powerful person. You know, in other words, you've brought it together and synthesized that there's no problem. Either you've successfully thrown out or absorbed their philosophy. And then the fifth now is the same. You give the conclusion. So the first and the fifth, there's no argument. You know, so only in the second and third you're actually dealing. But you're only dealing with argument in the third. Means this is just a matter of in relationship to what we were doing before, is why it would be like this. Is that means the first one is intellectual, so there's nothing really to grasp onto. The second one, then it starts to bring it, you know, into, you know, action and stuff like that, which the mind can grasp. So that's where doubts, because doubts are in the mind. Intelligence has no doubts or misgivings. It simply says there's 20 columns here, you know. But then the doubt comes up, you know, the mind, is it strong enough, or did we overbuild and waste money, or, you know, doesn't it look stupid, or, you know, should we put another line down the middle, or, you know, that's the mind. So doubts come up in the mind. So only in the second place then enough is given. In other words, the first one you make the point so the intelligence catches it. The second point you try to make it so the mind can appreciate it. But in doing that, it will flush out any doubts and misgivings that are there. Because if you don't know them, how will you deal with it? Then, yeah. That makes sense. So the third one, then, basically, you're using the intelligence, but you're working in the field of mind. That's why you give examples, because examples the mind can accept. You know, they're within the sphere. So therefore, your means your first and second, it doesn't matter who your audience is, they are as they are. But this third one is going to be according to the audience. You're going to give examples, you're going to use tone of voice, vocabulary, everything that those people will understand. Because the first two are so simple, you don't need to. Second one, maybe a little bit, you're careful with your words. But the first one is Krishna's God. Okay, you can say that to a three-year-old, you can say that to a PhD, it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. Second one, then you may be a little more careful with your words, but otherwise you don't really have to be. But the third one is then you choose the examples that fit the person and their doubt. And then the fourth one will then be Now that's really the samas. You're bringing it together. So now there's no problem. So you're trying to make the mind very comfortable with it. You know, the third one, you're clearing the mind of any problems that it accepts it. But the fourth one, you're making comfortable that, yes, this is, I accept this. Does that make sense? Yeah, and then the fifth one is now you want to practically apply it. So now you need the focus of the intelligence and the acceptance of the mind, and now you're going to do it. You know. So in other words, it's kind of like the first is the gyan and the fifth is the vigyan. You know, or the first is your theory and your fifth is your practical application. No, technically they're not different, the first and the fifth. But at the same time, is the fifth is different because it has gone through that whole process.
It's kind of like what they call the dialectic. You know, you come in a wonderful circle, you end up in the same place, but
at a higher point. Yeah. Well, that's the hermeneutics, is that it comes back around to the point. So it's not circular reasoning. You know, like that. It's different. In this, your modern debate, we'll call this thesis, antithesis, and synthesis. So they will take the first, second, and fourth. You know what I'm saying? Because the first is your thesis. The second you explain your thesis, that arises in the opposition there, the antithesis. Right. Mm-hmm. So then the third part's actually the debate, the discussion's in the third part. You know, you'll make your points, they'll ask their questions, make their points, you'll like that. Then in the fourth, that's the synthesis, so that the two seemingly opposing arguments have been reconciled.
I'm okay.
Yeah, like that. But it's okay. It's you're okay. I'm okay. You're okay. But we're both okay on my terms, because it's my thesis. It's my thesis. I'm taking it and going home.
And what's the Sanskrit that is different?
That I don't remember, but there's two different sets of means. Vyasadeva gives one set of terms, and Gotama, you know, because Nyaya is his system, gives another set. Like that. That's why there's a confusion, because sometimes the Sanskrit word is defined in a different way, but actually there's just different aspects of the same. But Vyasadeva means it's more of, you know, you're clearing the doubts and trying to establish. You know, but Gotama is just a system of argumentation. Mm-hmm. There's no conclusion specifically to Nyaya like that, but Vyasadeva there is. So that's why there'll be a difference in the presentation like that. But the point is we use both. You know, if you're talking to devotees and there's no opposition, you don't have to get so much into it. But even then, you'll see Prabhupada go, some may say. That's giving the antithesis. And then he'll give the example. Or he'll give the example, and maybe in the example, the other guy's, you know, he's okay with what you said, but when you gave the example, then the doubt comes up. Mm-hmm. You know, like I say everything's connected to Krishna, this, that, fine. Then I talk about the column. Well, if the column go, what about rock music? Mm-hmm. Because because then it becomes a doubt, because then it throws a doubt on actually if the column is done in the... And this quote is from where? But is that the one of Prabhupada? Because there's there is a quote where Prabhupada says that we must present it like this.
These are the Sanskrit terms.
Yeah, here are Sanskrit terms that are connected. At the same time as there's on the others, there's some overlap. The first level, it's all the same. But when you get into the Bhupurva Paksha, the antithesis, its main voicing will come up when you get to the third. Though the doubt kind of is, but it's expressed in the third. Just like there's a difference between the first and second, it's the same thing, but when it's expansion. So the doubt comes up in the second, but in the third it will be expressed. So therefore you give your examples to and your evidence to cut it. Because generally what happens is that why it doesn't work is because they take the other five and try to put it like that when it actually goes like that.
Okay.
You know, so that's why it, you know. So it, that's it, but it, you know, in
and this is according to Vedavyasa's work.
It's I don't know which one is which there, uh-huh. But I'm not sure that Prabhupada doesn't use Gotama's terms.
Okay.
Like that.
Did I get a borrow this and put a copy?
Yeah.
I'll give it to Thursday morning. Is that okay? Mm-hmm. No problem. Okay.
Like that, because Prabhupada mentions, and he also I think quotes from Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur that all. You know, discussions or presentations in the Vedic, you know, assembly of you know, how you say, you know, the devotees are like that, must be presented according to this.
Makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, it is. It's very much. It's a very essential study. It's simple, but it's important. But once one gets this, one can see Prabhupada's purports. They follow this exactly.
Strengthen your faith.
It won't be outside of that.
Yeah.
Like that. You can expand it. If you're expanding on Abhideya or Prayojana, then you get the what's in the Bhagavad Arkamrichamala.
Yeah.
But if it's not, then the basic that. And if it's even more simple, everything, if you don't quite know how to kind of categorize it, you can put it into Sambandha, Abhideya, or Prayojana. Mm-hmm. You know, so the first seven will be Sambandha. You'll have Shastra, then the first seven, it'll be Sambandha. The eighth, I mean, the ninth will be Abhideya, the tenth will be Prayojana. So even if you can't distinguish in there exactly which one it is within the seven, then it doesn't matter because you know it's Sambandha. Like that.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Yeah.
You said 10 minutes and it's already 20.
Yeah, well, that's the problem with these things. It's very hard to stop talking.
And Sangati, that's.
That's part of that fifth.
That's part of the fifth. What are the other parts? The other part of this Nigamana
Siddhanta. Siddhanta means your conclusion.
Yeah.
You know, Nigamana means, you know, it's probably, I'm not sure, it just means that you've, you know, cleared everything and now it's just, you know, it's. Yeah, Nigama Kalpa Tarugam Kampala. It's just, you know, it's like it's, you know, fixed, focused, like that. So then, but in that is the element of Sangati. You have to be able to connect it because then that goes on, leads on to other points. Like if you want to make another point, like you have in the Vedanta Sutra, you have the Anuchetas, like that. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that Jiva doesn't do that with Satsandarbhas also. He groups his points. Yeah.
He does it sometimes.
Yeah, so that one group of Anucheta, that all those whatever's in there, let's say there's 10 verses in that will be according to this five. And the last one will have something that connects it to the first one, the next verse, which is the first one, the next Anucheta.
Mm-hmm.
Like that. And then
Anucheta is
basically Sangati. No, the Anucheta is a it would be a theme.
Uh-huh, okay, yeah.
You know, there's this theme, and then, you know, like Atato Brahma Jigyasa, mm-hmm. that's a theme. The first 11 are, I think, one Anucheda. I think it is. Like that. Because they also, I think, say, I think, I'm not sure if it's Baladev says, or Ramanuja, one or the other, says if you study the Vedanta Sutra with his commentary for the first 11, basically you understand the whole thing. After that, it's just detail. Everything's been worked in. I don't remember if it's Baladev. One of them said the first 4. In other words, they worked everything they'd want to say in the whole Vedanta Sutra into the first 4 commentaries, or first 11 commentaries. I think Ramanuja is 4 and Baladev is 11. So I think that's a group, either that or that's 2. I don't, it's sort of, it's just, you know, as an example of saying that.
The other day you asked me about the information from the Sandhavas for Maharaj, Madras Research Group. Remember last time I gave you the categorization I've been done for the first 9 cantos? I don't know that much more is being done on that, but I can check when I go back, because Guruji Prabhu is going to be starting the 10th canto in January, so he may have done the 10th. And but the Ranganath Prabhu is presently working on the Sandhavas. So I can just check with them both when I get back and see
what
I can send them.
Yeah, okay.
And also Matsu is working on the translation of Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur's commentary on both of them, which is ecstatic. I don't know whether I brought it with me. I may have, because I wanted to study it, even I may have spaced out and forgot it. But just the first, the commentary on the first verse of Bhagavatam is mind blowing.
He takes it syllable by syllable and shows Krishna's whole pastimes.
Not only that, but he actually looks at it from 5 different perspectives. From the perspective of Krishna as a person, Krishna in terms of Paramatma and Brahma, devotional service, Radharani, and Brahma. I mean, it's just like mind-blowing the way he explains it. Well, if I brought it, I can make a photocopy for him. And if the other, you know, when I go back, I can find what I can find and see.
Must be a little bit of a speaking.
Pretty special.
Get
this about those in comparison.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay.